actually 40.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. We're going to be together for about 40 minutes, and I'm going to have the board introduce ourselves. At the end, when you leave, you can walk around and shake our hands and hand cards, and I called the Don Vasconcelles really touchy moment.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'm Maria Baramontes, chair of the retirement board, and I'm going to ask Jerry, my colleague over here, to begin.
Jerry Holcomb, trustee.
Terry Bush, trustee.
John Phillips, trustee.
Marilyn Leben, CEO.
And Maria.
Jerry Tellis, retiree trustee. I'm sorry, I'm reading what you just passed out.
Trustee Watts, trustee.
Deborah Allen, trustee.
Gabe Rodriguez, trustee.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Aether, could you please introduce yourself?
Certainly, I'm David Rhodes from Aether, joined by Troy Schell and Sean Goodrich here.
Thank you.
If you'd like, I can hop right into it. I'll take a cue from you.
Okay. I'm going to let you introduce your colleagues. First thing, you have confidential. This is a public meeting, so we need you to waive that for the discussion.
We understand you.
Okay, thank you. And basically, I'm going to let you walk through about your company, about this type of investment in real assets, and then, you know, the board just kind of intersperses as you go along with questions, if we can keep it that informal.
Great, yeah.
We want you to feel comfortable. This is really a discussion, you know, so that's how we look at it.
Should we dive in?
Yep.
Yeah.
What your gentleman's names? I'm sorry.
I'm Troy.
And I'm Sean Goodrich.
Okay. We'll go through our backgrounds here in just a bit. The first page just offers an overview of Aether.
Okay.
So I'm David Rhodes. I can start with that, and I'll turn it over to Troy and Sean to discuss their founding of Aether. So Aether's an independent investment manager. We're based in Denver, Colorado, and we're there by design. There are some strategic advantages to our being in Denver, which we'll touch on a bit later in the presentation. We're a single strategy firm focused exclusively on real assets. And for us internally, we define real assets as primarily natural resources investments. commonly, you'll hear real estate referred to as real assets. That's one area we don't participate in. So you won't see any commercial real estate or residential real estate in Aether's portfolios. So there shouldn't be any overlap with your real estate managers in that regard. One of our core beliefs at Aether is alignment of interest between ourselves and our limited partners. And the best way we know how to strengthen that alignment is by having the general partner of each Aether fund itself commit to the fund. So alongside of our limited partners, the GP will commit 1% to each Aether fund. And that represents each of our respective commitments, and the GP represents the vast majority of our net worth. So we think that strengthens our alignment with our investors. Aether has presently 5 employees. So there's Troy and Sean, who are the founders of the firm and the portfolio managers. I serve as chief operating officer, and we're supported by 2 investment analysts who are back home at the office right now. We'll go through everybody's backgrounds in a bit more detail on the next page. But to date, we've raised 2 funds. Aether Real Assets 1 held a final close in 2010 on $127 million in aggregate commitments. And Aether Real Assets 2 held a final close in 2012 on $303 million in aggregate commitments. That fund was heavily oversubscribed, so we limited the fund size to $300 million there, and there was probably a couple hundred million more in interest that we had to turn away based on our hard cap of $300 million in that fund. The last bullet you'll note on this page is that we're going to begin fundraising for our third fund later this summer, Aether Real Assets 3, and that'll share an identical strategy and structure to ARA 2. Even the hard cap will remain the same, so that'll be capped at $300 million again. So we expect there's going to be significantly more interest than we can accommodate in ARA 3 as well. With that, I'll turn it over to these guys to discuss the genesis of Aether and their own backgrounds.
Great. Again, I'm Sean Goodrich, and really to bring you to the beginning of Aether, I have to go back to the summer of 2000, which is when I first met Troy. We both attended business school together at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. So I guess at this point, this summer, it will be 13 years that we've known each other, and we've been collaborating on real asset opportunities now for over 10 years. And I think between the two of us, we've made over 60 investments to real asset funds, with the last 5, or almost 5, as of October, side by side inside of Aether. We ultimately chose to leave our prior employers for two important reasons and start a single product firm for two important reasons. Number one, we think it creates better alignment between ourselves and our investors. You know, the fact that we're investing what will ultimately be the vast majority of our net worth inside our funds alongside our investors, we think speaks to that alignment. But it also allows us to avoid a lot of the distractions associated with other products inside of a multi-product firm. Troy and I both came from firms that had a number of different things going on outside of real assets, and I think we both found that we were pulled into meetings that didn't necessarily relate to what we wanted to do, which was ultimately invest in the real asset space. And everything at Aether is singularly focused on one opportunity, one strategy, one set of funds at any given time, all in the real asset space. For me, I actually started out on Wall Street on a trading desk, and most of my pre-MBA experience was on or around trading desks before going to Carolina. After business school, I ended up joining an institutional investment consulting firm in Minneapolis named Jeffrey Slocum & Associates, where I was the director of alternative investment research. What was really fortunate for me was at the time when I joined Slocum, had no exposure to real assets. And over the 6 years that I was there, I led the development of the firm's real asset program from scratch. And ultimately, when I left in October of 08, we had over $2 billion of client assets committed to real asset funds across 40-plus managers globally. And what's important about that is it coincided with the development of the real asset program at BlackRock or Qualos at the time, which is where Troy was. So you can imagine what ended up happening is we were always on the phone talking about the real asset space, collaborating on research on real assets. We shared a lot of manager names back and forth. We collaborated on due diligence on managers that we were considering at the same time. We ultimately invested in a lot of the same funds. We were sitting on advisory boards together. We were going to annual meetings together. So over the course of that six-year period for me, somewhere in between the beginning and the end, this idea for Aether ultimately hatched, and we officially opened our doors in October of 2008.
As Sean mentioned, after business school, I went to Qualos, which is in Seattle. I was a member of the private capital team. I joined that team about 9 months after its formation. I served as a portfolio manager for the Real Assets Fund of Funds program. I was at Qualos from July of 2002 until October of 2007, at which point BlackRock acquired Qualos. At that time, the private equity and real assets teams formally split into separate groups. It was a transition that was coming for several years. It was formalized at that point. I moved over in the same role, same responsibility, again based in Seattle. And from that point forward, the Real Assets program was run from Seattle with oversight by a gentleman named Gene McDonald, who was the founder of the private capital group at Qualos. Gene was based in Durham and was a fantastic mentor for me. He was Gene, I guess, was early, mid-70s by that point, so he wasn't very active day-to-day, but certainly a very valuable resource for our team, even to that point. Obviously, I stayed at BlackRock for 1 year, after which we left to start Aether. At Qualos, we raised two real assets fund of funds. The first was raised in 2003. It was called Qualos Real Assets One. That was a $230 million fund. The second fund that we raised was in 2006. That was a $385 million fund. So obviously, Aether Real Assets 3, which is the fund that we're talking about today, will be the fifth fund that I've managed or co-managed, obviously, in the case of Aether.
And Troy and I met back in 2002. I was actually at Qualos as well, whereas Troy was focused on real assets. I was over on the hedge fund to fund side, supporting our marketing and client servicing efforts to institutional investors like yourselves. I left Qualos in 2004 to move to Denver and work for a hedge fund there, where I ultimately led the client servicing and marketing efforts for that firm, which included some fund structuring as well and separate account structuring. And then in 2008, when Sean and Troy moved to town, Troy introduced me to Sean, I think the second week they were in town. And shortly thereafter, we started discussing our chief operating officer role at Aether. And the catalyst for me to come over and join was their closing ARA 1 in 2010. Once that was finally closed, I came over and joined first week of January 2011. So my role at Aether is to focus on everything non-investment related, to try and pull the business management stuff away from Troy and Sean so they're freed up to focus on the portfolios alone. In addition, we have two investment analysts back home on the desk that I mentioned. They support Troy and Sean on the investment side of things. We'll add a third investment analyst about this time next year. And actually, one of our former investment analysts who left to go back to UNC, he'll be graduating from business school and will come back and rejoin us as well. His name's John Hendrickson. So We're five today. That'll bring us to seven this time next year, and all seven of those people will be focused exclusively on real assets, since that's our only focus.
I'm going to ask you this question now because I know it will be asked by our board. We have small funds invested, and we have large funds. We have an interesting mix of folks that we work with. But we always ask this question about key man risk. You two are the core brain cell of your operation. So share with us a little bit how you address that issue in your small firm going forward.
Yeah, I think the first step is bringing John Hendrickson back. John and I have worked together for 8 years now. So John is a very experienced guy, and it's John will clearly come back in a more senior position than he left, a lot more senior position than he left. The key man risk is a double-edged sword, though. The good part about key man risk in a small firm is there's complete transparency. You know exactly who's responsible for what. With a larger firm, oftentimes that can be veiled a little bit. We do operate from different locations, which is helpful. I'm based in Seattle today. We moved down to Denver, have since relocated back to Seattle. So that means fewer flights together than would have been the case when I was in Denver. But I'm the only member of the team based remotely. Everyone else is based in Denver.
Obviously, there's also a provision in our partnership agreement that basically allows investors to potentially step in if one of us chooses to leave and stop the commitment period of Aether. So at that point, you would not be at risk for any additional dollars that would be potentially committed to underlying funds.
So I'm going to ask the question, are you both planning to stay here?
Yeah,
absolutely.
So you can see we're usually picked on for being a little bit young. So we have a lot of time left in these seats for sure.
Right. Thank you.
And
question.
You own the company.
And we're owners of the company, yeah.
You have capital in, so.
Absolutely.
And neither one of you is a hang glider.
Yeah. No.
All right, thank you for
not
answering
anymore.
That question.
Not anymore. Well, based on that then, how big do you want your company to get?
Not by design. We want to stay small. Single product firm is our plan forever, and modest size funds forever. You know, that's really designed to drive investment performance. We think the bigger you get, the harder it is to produce returns. So smaller is better almost in all regards. It doesn't mean that we sacrifice resources. We use plenty of third parties that David can address, but we want to make sure that the key team, we know exactly what everyone's doing. There's good accountability, efficiency, productivity, et cetera.
Troy, what metrics do you use to determine that $300 million is your right size?
You know, it's a good question. So the business plan for Aether has played out almost exactly as we'd planned, which is surprising to even us, you know, what they say about the best laid plans. But even in our original business plan, we contemplated a second, third fund about $300 million. We were blessed to have more interest than we frankly could have expected when we started the business in our second fund. The reason for that modest size fund is really to make sure that if there were one or two investments in any of our funds that we really wanted to make and really wanted to make material to the fund, but there was limited capacity, that we could make those very material to the fund. So it's really focused on the one or two outliers out of about 10 investments that we'll make in a fund that we want to make very material to the performance of that fund as well.
Before we move on, Troy alluded to our service providers. So Sean and Troy were wise in the way they set up the firm. We stick to our core competencies and outsource everything else. So we use an administrator in town called Stonepine Administrative Services, which basically is our outsourced CFO. They handle all of our client account statements, financials, everything like that. And they administer about $30 billion for private equity fund to fund. So they're very good at what they do. We work closely with them. We have a research database provider based between us and Boulder that customizes Salesforce.com for us. We work closely with them because as Marilyn and Tim and Jeff can attest to, we have a very complete resource database that we use every step of the way. And then lastly, we have a legal firm based in actually North Carolina that we work closely with for all of our legal needs. So we don't have in-house counsel, in-house CFO, or an in-house chief technology officer. With that, we can probably skip over the next couple pages, given your familiarity with real assets and why we're here today. And maybe focus in on page 6, which gets into the structure and strategy of the Area 3.
This page obviously describes the structure and strategy for Area 3, but it's almost identical to what do the same page would have shown for Eighth Real Assets 1 and Eighth Real Assets 2. We're focused on private investments in natural resources. And we want to invest as close to the point of commodity production as we can. Our view is that the closer you get to the point of commodity production, the better the hedge against inflation should be. That hedge against inflation is one of the unique characteristics of real assets. So as you could imagine, there's a high bar for us to move away from that point of commodity production, which we refer to as the upstream segment. We expect Area 3 to be comprised of 10 to 15 underlying commitments. Practically, we go into each fund expecting 10 to 12 investments. We made 10 investments in 8th Real Assets 1. We expect again to finish 8th Real Assets 2 with 10 commitments. At least 70% of the portfolio will be invested in the primary sectors that you see listed there of oil and gas, metals and minerals, agriculture and timber. We think it's important, though, not to predefine how allocations will be made within the primary sectors. There can be times when sectors get overheated. Timber, Midwestern row crop agricultural investments are examples today of things that are overheated, in our view, are not a very attractive risk-return trade-off. I think we can demonstrate that we added a lot of value in 8th Real Assets 1 and 2 through that opportunistic approach, but we didn't sacrifice meaningful diversification. I think that'll become transparent when we take you through those portfolios. Up to 30% of the portfolio can be invested in the opportunistic sectors that you see, for example, power or water. That 30%, though, really should be viewed as a cap and not a target. We don't go into a fund expecting to make opportunistic investments, but we have made a couple in 8th Real Assets 1 and one in 8th Real Assets 2. We do hold some biases, though, that tend to steer us away from those opportunistic areas, and Sean will touch on those in a minute. The portfolio is likely to be biased towards North America. We do see opportunities growing rapidly outside of North America, though. For us to invest in a non-North American fund, generally you're going to accept some degree of currency exposure, so it's got to be that much more additive to our portfolio for us to accept that additional risk. And we have to be able to diligence those fund managers just as we would diligence any fund manager in the U.S., and we can touch on our approach to diligence as well. We will consider secondary investments. We've looked at a lot. We haven't done anything yet, but we will not consider co-investments. Our experience has shown that co-investments come with a lot of conflicts. They demand a lot of resources, and in our space, require very specialized expertise. Co-investments in real assets are not like co-investments in private equity or hedge funds, for example. That's our view. Our goal at the end of the day is to produce a 12 to 15% return net of all fees and expenses in a flat commodity price environment. In addition to that, there should be a positive correlation to commodity prices. So to the extent commodity prices increase, we should enjoy a bit of a tailwind. To the extent that commodity prices decline, we should face a bit of a headwind.
Troy, a co-investment is?
Co-investment would be an underlying fund manager offers investors in the fund the right to invest in investment they're making from the fund on the side, which we think tends to steer people. And I've been involved with co-investments in the past at Qualys and BlackRock, and in my view is even if you don't, even if you try to resist, there are conflicts that arise. You might be steered towards bigger funds that will drive co-investments or show you the opportunity for co-investments, and it will ultimately affect your core portfolio. So we've chosen to avoid that conflict. Conflicts are something that we think and Marilyn and Jeff got a good sense for. We're very sensitive to conflicts, and we want to avoid them at every turn.
Can you share a little bit about what type of agricultural investments you've made?
We'll highlight our first two funds in a few pages, but most of what we've done has been focused on U.S. agriculture investments, basically farmland investments, and primarily in permanent crops, so things like fruits, citrus, for example. As a matter of fact, one of our allocations is right here, well, just north of us, I guess, in the Central Valley, a group that's focused on citrus and table grapes, primarily in the Central Valley of California. Recently, one of our newest allocations is focused on more annual or row crops, those things like wheat, corn, in places like the Pacific Northwest, Montana, Idaho, et cetera, et cetera. But as Troy mentioned, there is a tremendous amount of growth in all of our sectors, particularly outside of North America, so we've also considered some farmland opportunities outside of North America. One of our opportunistic investments is focused on agribusinesses in South America, for example. So there we don't actually own farms, but we own things like grain storage and processing and seed and fertilizer companies and things like that instead.
I was kind of impressed with your list of contacts, over 18,000 for such a small firm. Share with us how that came about and how you contact those companies, those resources.
I guess it starts with the way that we designed the database. We spent 3 months when we started the firm almost full-time building out the construct of the database. And then from that point, it's important to make maintaining the database a religion within the firm. And if that doesn't come from the top, it's not going to get implemented. We're very religious about entering every contact that we come across in our database, creating connections in our database, et cetera. That really bears fruit when we get to the point of identifying investments and evaluating investments.
Page 7 shows a few biases that Troy and I have developed over the courses of our careers. And the first notes are biased towards smaller funds. And really, our experience has taught us that there's just greater inefficiencies in the sponsored market. For example, operationally, typically greater operational inefficiecies in small deals as those assets are either owned by, you know, small mom and pop types of operators that might not be that sophisticated, or they're owned by large companies, so their small fields are often the ones that are the most neglected. Also, smaller transactions tend to be much less efficiently priced than large transactions. In many of the small transactions our managers pursue, they're typically directly negotiated between themselves and the seller, as opposed to large deals, which almost always go through brokers or investment bankers. And in fact, what you typically see is that the large funds are not only competing with each other for these opportunities, they're competing with public companies. In the end, in order to win those transactions, you have to be the group that is willing to bid the highest priced, or another way to think about it is a group that's willing to take the most risk. And again, you know, as you've heard us say a number of times already, we're big believers in alignment. And frankly, we firmly believe that managers of smaller funds are better aligned with us. For example, the carried interest or the profit participation component of their compensation is actually very meaningful to small managers, and it drives a focus on generating investment results that is often lacking at large firms, where we know and we've heard from some of their partners, ex-partners, and principals that their primary goal is increasing their fund sizes to generate greater management fee revenue, because that's how they view their path to wealth creation. In the end, though, small does not mean inexperienced. And in fact, many of our smallest managers are the most experienced inside of our portfolio. Because if there's one thing we would categorically not do, it's invest in a new team, investing capital in a new strategy. The second bullet on this page notes our preference or our bias towards groups that have really deep operational and technical expertise in the sectors in which they invest. So, for example, if you were to look at the resumes of our managers, you know, they didn't really come from Wall Street. They would have been reservoir engineers in the oil and gas space before becoming oil and gas private equity managers, or geologists in the mining space, or farm managers in the farmland space before becoming investors. And that's very important to us because we're keenly focused on allocating to groups that are very good at creating value in their properties after they've bought it and before they've sold it in a very hands-on or operational way. Because in our opinion, groups that are able to create value directly in the property through these operational improvements really generate a return that is independent of peer commodity price movements, which in our opinion reduces the risk of our overall portfolio. So when Troy talked about that 12 to 15% return plus the commodity correlation, that 12 to 15% really comes from the operational improvements they can generate inside the assets, which clearly you can't do if you only come from an investment banking background, for example. We also strongly prefer groups that own and operate the assets directly, which we refer to as the direct model, as opposed to the indirect model where groups are allocating to other management teams that then go out and own and operate the assets directly. That's important for us because there's dramatically lower fees associated with the direct model relative to the indirect model. So most of our groups, by and large, own and operate the assets directly as opposed to allocating capital to other teams that then own and operate the assets. Those other teams then charge our managers or those other managers that promote, which basically doubles your fees there. So we're very keen to focus on groups that own and operate assets directly. And finally, the last bullet notes a couple of things that we seek to avoid. Number one is groups that require high levels of leverage to achieve the kinds of returns we're looking for. And frankly, in our opinion, if you're really good at operating assets or transforming assets operationally, you shouldn't need a lot of leverage to achieve the kinds of returns we're trying to generate in our portfolio. And then the second thing we'll seek to avoid is groups that require technological innovation to drive their results or technology risk. Frankly, in our opinion, that's the kind of risk that should be assumed maybe in a venture capital portfolio. It's a much higher risk profile than what we're trying to assume in our portfolio, and we'd be better served elsewhere in your private capital allocation. So because of the fact that we seek to avoid leverage, you won't, for example, see us allocating to a lot of infrastructure funds, which are typically highly levered. And because of the fact that we won't, or we'll seek to avoid groups that take on a lot of technology risk, we wouldn't allocate to any clean tech funds or things like that.
John, what are some examples of technology innovation risks?
It would be, for example, if you are investing in a company that is trying to create the next solar technology to increase the efficiency of solar cells. And it's not a proven technology. It's really experimental at that point, and it's a sort of a small venture capital-like investment. That would be the kind of risk that we would not assume.
Now, would that come up in the world you're in? I guess I'm looking more for one that would be applicable to what you're otherwise looking at to invest in.
Yeah, typically not. I mean, when Troy talked about our primary areas of focus, oil and natural gas, metals and minerals, agriculture and timber, certainly it's not going to come up there. Where it could come up would be in the opportunistic sectors that we can consider, such as alternative and renewable energy, which we haven't done any of to date because of that primarily.
So fracking might.
Yeah.
Well, fracking would be something that we could do because it's a newer technique and associated with newer technologies, but it's been used now for decades, and at this point it's very proven. So people consider it newer, but the reality is at this point it's really just proven and the newest technology, but not a new technology.
An example of something at Quellos that was done on the private capital side but not on the real asset side was a company that had developed a new very new technique to try and identify oil and gas reserves using satellite imagery. And in our view, that was too early, and it proved to be the case. The company ended up filing for bankruptcy. The next page covers our investment process. It's pretty difficult to cover this concisely. I'm going to hit a couple key points, but and Marilyn, Tim, and Jeff have seen our database and I think should have a pretty good feel for our process at this point. We've been told by managers and investors that our process is the most thorough in the industry. We don't have a point of comparison. We'll take their word for it, I guess, but we'll leave that up to you to ultimately determine. I'm going to cover identification and evaluation on the next page, and we've already covered portfolio construction on page 7. So let me touch briefly on monitoring. Before we move on, it's an aspect of our process that oftentimes is ignored in our business and we take very seriously. Really starts with advisory committee participation. We participate on nearly every advisory committee of underlying funds in which we invest. Those oftentimes are the steering body and the greatest form of input from limited partners in those funds is on that advisory committee. We review every investment in every underlying portfolio on a quarterly basis. And we log the details of those investments in our database quarterly. Now, what that allows us to do is to track trends in portfolios or in deals over time. It allows us to track actual results relative to expectations as well. It's a very valuable tool. That's in addition to very frequent contact with our managers on either formal or ad hoc basis. The next page covers what we view as...
Before you leave that, could you share how you exit? I went through these steps, identification, evaluation, construction, and monitoring. At what point do you say, this is the moment, we got to go?
Yeah.
Is there a moment, and what's the tipping point on that moment?
And so that would really fall in the evaluation category. That's where, so identification is you find an investment and then it goes into the process. So once it's been identified, it moves to the next box. The evaluation process is, you know, I wish we had brought the flow chart that we showed, showed everyone in our office, but it's a very exhaustive process. It includes a variety of meetings, reference checks, operational reviews, references very heavily. It's not until we've answered every question that we can think to ask that we move on. And those questions are both kind of systematic and ad hoc depending on that investment. So we maintain a series of checklists that help us make sure that we don't miss anything that we want to apply commonly across diligence of all funds. And then we maintain an investment specific list we call the key issues and action items list. Key issues would be generally call it 4 to 6 considerations that if we can't get comfortable with, we're gonna move on and pass on the investment. The action items oftentimes are either less significant items or they tie back to those key issues. It's basically once we've exhausted that entire list and all the checklists that we would be ready to make an investment.
Terry and Jerry.
I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. So who makes the final call whether to invest or not invest?
The two of us. It sounds more formal than it is.
And then what happens if it's a tie?
There's never been a tie. I think the
David breaks the ties.
Yeah.
Arm wrestle.
The approach that we've taken is if we're both not comfortable, we're not making the investment. I really believe in the saying that what's not in your portfolio can't hurt you. So if we don't both believe strongly in an investment, we're just going to move on to the next one.
Practically speaking, it really would never get to that point because it would be killed much sooner in our process than in the final vote.
Okay, Jerry?
No, that was my question.
Okay, and Bob?
Following up on Maria Teresa's question, would you ever, you buy secondaries, would you ever unload prior to the termination of the fund?
We haven't really had a situation where we've been that close to the termination of a fund to consider it, but I think we would definitely consider it. I mean, frankly, at that point, price is everything. So I see scenarios where people are offering us bids on parts of our portfolio that they know that we own, probably being the more likely outcome versus us proactively trying to go out and sell in the secondary market pieces of our portfolio. But in the end, if somebody comes in with a strong enough bid, it's ultimately all about expected return. You know, one other comment about process and getting from one part of the process to another. You know, we all sit out in an open desk layout where everybody's right there basically on one long desk and we can see and hear exactly what everybody else is doing. So every step of our process is extremely collaborative. And frankly, we get off the phone from a conference call with a manager. We're immediately discussing that call and deciding what next steps are. So, you know, we're not proceeding on those steps unless at every point of that process, everybody's basically on board and knows exactly what we're going to do next. So it's not as if Troy and I are sitting in corner offices somewhere and our analysts are down the hall in cubicles and stuff like that. We're all right there making these decisions real time.
Now, I mentioned that I work from Seattle. I'm actually on a video screen all day with live audio. So it's like I'm sitting at the desk as well. It's really... if anyone's passing through Seattle, I'm happy to show it to you from my side as well. I mentioned, so on page 9, I want a couple of cover.
Are you at home in an office, or are you in an office?
Okay. I'm office. That's by design. At Carlos, we found that multiple office setup was confusing, so we've tried to address any limitations that there were with that setup with my relocation back to Seattle, and I think it's worked very effectively. It's worked far better than we could have even expected.
He spends about a week in the Denver office anyway, a month. We spend about a week together on the road a month, so half the time we're together, basically, and half the time we're more or less looking at Troy on a screen at the end of the desk and hearing him in real time, too. So,
you run like a loop, so you're always sitting there.
Yeah, that would be a nice function to have. Unfortunately, it doesn't.
It's not Tron, yeah.
But it's worked very well.
I want to give you at least 2 more minutes for you to sum up where the most important points you'd like to make for us, and then I'll just ask one more time for the board when you get done with that if there's any more questions.
Yeah.
I know someone will ask you about fees, so you might want to cover that on your own.
Yep.
Richard's not here. He would ask you that first thing.
Yeah, I think we should let page 9 speak for itself, page 10 as well, perhaps.
Can you just talk to Fund 1 and the performance there real quick, and then I can give you a quick snapshot of what we've done in Fund 1 and Fund 2 before we can talk about Fund 3 and fees and terms and stuff like that. But go ahead, David.
You want to just skip right to the bottom of page 13 shows, this is as of 12/31, our most recent audited figures.
Yes,
it shows the performance of Fund 1 so far. You'll notice at the bottom there, our total value to paid in capital multiple on a net basis is 1.31 times. And then just below that, you can see our net IRR as of 12/31 in ARA 1 was 21.1%.
Now, obviously, that gross and net number will converge over time as more capital is called, just to be clear.
Congratulations.
And page 14 shows what we've actually committed to in our first fund, which at this point is 100% committed and almost two-thirds drawn. But we ultimately made 10 allocations, 5 in the oil and gas space, 3 of those managers focused on U.S. oil and gas opportunities, and 2 focused on Canadian oil and gas opportunities. 2 mining allocations, 1 agriculture allocation, and then 2 that we classify as opportunistic, 1 group that's in the power space and 1 group that is sort of focused on products and services associated with natural resources industries. We're pretty active investors, both pre-investment and post-investment. Troy talked a little bit about our due diligence process, but in a lot of these funds and a similar number of funds in ARA 2, we've been able to achieve significant gains for our investors through reduced fees that we've negotiated and passed through to our investors, along with just all the work that we do on governance terms and things like that associated with these opportunities. But even post-investment, we're very active monitors, and we sit on the advisory board of almost all of the funds in which we've invested, 9 of 10. Out of Aether Real Assets 1. Aether Real Assets 2 is on page 16. We typically don't provide performance until the fund is at least one-third called, only because early performance isn't meaningful, though I think we're ahead of where we expected we would be at this point and are still showing a positive IRR technically as of the end of last year. But page 16 shows the 8 investments that we've made so far in Aether Real Assets 2. And again, this portfolio is going to trend towards 10. So we basically have 2 more commitments to make before we're officially done with Aether Real Assets 2 and basically investing Aether Real Assets 3 at this point. So the profile of the fund looks very similar to Aether Real Assets 1, which is what we expected. We've got 3 oil and gas funds to date, although a bit more diversity there is one's focused on the U.S., 1 on Canada, and 1 outside of North America. 2 mining funds, both of those funds are focused globally. 2 agriculture funds, 1 focused on sort of the corn and wheat in places like the Pacific Northwest and Montana, and the other being that fund in the Central Valley here of California focused primarily on citrus and table grapes. And then to date, 1 opportunistic investment, and that was the agribusiness firm I mentioned focused on South American agribusinesses. Between Aether Real Assets 1 and Aether Real Assets 2, there's probably 10 or so of those funds that would be potentially re-up candidates for Aether Real Assets 3. So when we start to think about what the portfolio for Aether Real Assets 3 will look like, it's going to be likely dominated by managers we've already allocated to between our Fund 1 and our Fund 2.
Many of which have limited or no capacity for newer investors. We were early investors with them. We have a lot of flexibility in the allocations that we can get from those managers.
Yep. And then 17 just shows our pipeline. frankly, we sort of have already identified what will likely be the final 2 commitments to Aether Real Assets 2. So much of what's on this pipeline today is already being considered and potentially analyzed as an early allocation for Aether Real Assets 3.
Moving ahead at breakneck speed, we should probably just skip over these next several pages to 23, which is probably what you're fairly interested in, is the terms for ARA 3, which are going to be nearly identical to the terms for ARA 2. The cap, again, will be the same, $300 million, so the fund size will be limited to $300 million, same as with ARA 2. I'll just point out a couple of the items of interest. You'll note the commitment period says 2 to 3 years. I think in practice we expect it to be closer to 2 years, but we want to allow ourselves enough leeway. Management fee is 0.85% on committed capital annually for the first 5 years. Thereafter, that management fee steps down by 15% each year thereafter. The carried interest is 5%, and that's 5% to the GP only after the return of all your contributed capital, return of your fees, your expenses, and a 7% preferred return to limited partners. We are again offering a discount on that carried interest to anybody who comes into the first closing of Area 3, and that discount is going to be 25% off of the carried interest. That'll be prorated if the first close exceeds 150, but for example, if the first close is 150 million, everyone will get a 25% discount. If it ends up being 300 million, everyone will get a 12.5% discount on that carried interest. We've noted at the bottom, these are additional terms for a separate account structure we discussed with Tim and Marilyn and Jeff. If we call it the surplus fund, you can think of it like a separate account, however you like. Those are lower fees than the stated fees for ARA 3 above. So you'll note the management fee is, instead of 0.85%, it's 0.6%. And the carried interest, instead of 5%, is 3.5%.
Yeah, so as I understand it, you might not be able to put in a full allocation into the fund, and then it would have to go to the surplus.
Yeah, the way we have a handout that we'll leave you with, the way we're thinking about it is if you consider a separate account, the surplus fund, we would, you know, between the main fund and the surplus fund, we would guarantee you any allocation that's suitable for you. Under that scenario, more is better. It helps lower your average, you know, the fee per average dollar, and it helps with leverage with underlying funds. We expect probably, if we're going to make 10 investments in A3 Real Assets 3, probably 8 of those same investments occur within the surplus fund. If you preferred a simpler structure, which is just A3 Real Assets 3, in that scenario, we cannot guarantee a full allocation. Again, everyone's treated the same, subject to cutbacks. If you introduce the two together, we have the ability to shift things around a little bit, and we can guarantee whatever allocation is suitable for you. So long as the surplus is 50 million. 50 million is going to be the minimum to establish that.
Yeah.
So if we want to participate in that, it's at least 50 million.
Yeah, it'd probably be more like 65 or so. We expect that we wouldn't, if preferred, we wouldn't allocate you less than 20% of the total to the main fund. So 15 plus 50 is about 65 million.
So Troy, what kind of allocation would we be looking at in the main fund? What kind of capacity would you have for Contra Costa?
Yeah, we're prepared today to say no less than 20% of your allocation in the main fund if you want that. Obviously the goal would be to get you guys more than that though. In our minds, a perfect allocation would be call it 30 to 35%. So there's very meaningful exposure in the main fund, plus an allocation in a surplus fund, but we'd have to work on that a little bit, massage the timing a little bit for the first close to make sure that we could make an attempt to get you there. But today we would commit to at least 20% of that.
It's probably going to be determined by whether or not we're oversubscribed on the first close. But again, we turned away a couple hundred million in the final couple months of Aether Real Assets 2 on our $300 million hard cap. And you know, we've already gotten inquiries about Aether Real Assets 3. We just want to make sure that you're aware that that could be a possibility.
And the date of the first close is?
We've been saying first week of next year. I think the reality is, I would assume anytime between mid-November and first week of next year. Okay. Probably the.
How large would you allow the surplus fund to be?
Bigger is really better. And really, as there are two, as we think about the Area 3 portfolio and we assume 10 commitments, which is the most likely outcome, there are only two commitments where we have any question about getting a full allocation. So that means there will be available capacity for the surplus funds. So assume 8 out of 10. And in those 8, it's almost unlimited. The more, the better. So we'd have no.
A couple hundred million
would not be a problem.
In fact, we're talking with one other investor that's also a public plan that's a very large investor about a surplus fund concept for them as well. And I think they would, you know, start north of 100 million.
There'd obviously be, you know, be afforded some economies of scale at that point.
Thank you. Any last questions? Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks very much. Really. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for the rest of the question. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Good to see you again.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks
so much.
Thanks. Nice to meet you.
Really?
Nice to meet you.
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't smart enough.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to meet you, David.
Yes, that's right, to identify it as a...
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to stay as well.
Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That one actually wasn't...
It's that one. Give a bias in your voting.
That is...
So if you want to just grab coffee, then we'll just bring it in, but don't leave the room.
Yeah, so anyway, no need to bring it up.
That's all I know.
Thanks for pointing that out.
It's rare that one of those slips through.